This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the July 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. This issue entirely consists of articles about COVID-19. We will be speaking with JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepps Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is an associate professor of family medicine and director of the residency training program. The July 2020 issue of JAMDA has several research papers that provide useful clinical tidbits for clinicians caring for patients with suspected or confirmed COVID-19 in nursing homes. You know, Dr. Sloan, as providers and clinical and non-clinical healthcare staff, we are inundated daily with information about COVID-19. It may be from the news, from outlets, otherwise, or from society emails, but there's a ton of information coming through daily. What makes these JAMDA articles in July relevant information to share now?
What I would say about this is that as editors, we have chosen articles that really reflect the perspective of long-term care providers, and that's a voice that's not always heard in the media. There is so much out there that it's important to realize there's other things to do than COVID. But for today, we're going to talk about articles that we think have clinical relevance for the practice and also help us think more about where we're going.
Wonderful. So let's start talking about the paper by Dr. Rudolph and others regarding temperature and COVID-19. On a personal note, Jim Rudolph and I were in geriatric fellowship together, and he is a national leader on delirium, and he has also been on the AMDA On The Go podcast to talk about delirium. I was especially pleased to see his name on a JAMDA article and something we would be talking about today. And another author on the article, Aman Nandez, is the fellowship director for geriatrics at Brown, so a huge advocate of education. There has been substantive discussion lately around temperature taking in general. You know, what does this paper by Rudolph and others bring to the table? Why does it have relevance?
I think so. This paper is especially relevant because a lot of long-term care settings are taking a lot of temperatures, thinking that it can screen in and out coronavirus infection. And the challenge for medical directors and administrators is, what do you do with this information that you get, and is it really helpful? So to interpret a temperature, we need to know how many people develop a fever, when infected with the virus, and what the curve is like, and how you define fever. And this paper sheds some light on that issue. The investigators used data from the Veterans Administration's 134 community living centers, which are a lot like nursing homes. They tested all 7,325 residents in these centers for the SARS-CoV-2 virus during the single day in mid-April. Everybody got tested the same day.
Wow.
They also recorded a 4 a.m. temperature every day for the 14 days before and the 14 days after they did the test.
Wow.
Their goal was to see what the temperature pattern was for people who tested positive to get a better handle on how many people are truly asymptomatic and how effective it is to screen for coronavirus using body temperature. So this is relevant information in helping us interpret if we do temperatures on residents. In their analysis, they chose to just look at that 4 a.m. temperature. That way they would standardize their measure since temperature has a normal circadian variation. They also, using the CDC guidance, used a temperature threshold of 38 degrees centigrade, that's 100.4 Fahrenheit, to define fever. And we'll talk later about kind of what that means in terms of interpretation. Of the 7,325 tests, 453, that 6% came back positive for coronavirus. They found that when they looked at the four-week temperature curves of the people tested, the COVID-positive patients had exactly the same average baseline temperatures as non-COVID patients, 36.6 degrees Celsius. In other words, they confirmed once again that the average temperature for a nursing home resident is not 98.6 Fahrenheit, but instead there it's 97.8. They also found, as we had published a few years ago, that two standard deviations above normal is right around 99 degrees Fahrenheit. So we think 99.0 is a much more appropriate fever threshold for nursing home residents than 100.4. They also found that the COVID-positive residents had temperature elevations during that observation period, but their average peak was really just 37 degrees Celsius. That's 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. About 1 degree above their normal, but not quite meeting our 99 degree fever threshold. So what they found was that 1/4, 27%, exceeded the CDC's fever threshold of 38 degrees, or 100.4, sometime during the observation period, compared with only 3% of the COVID negative patients. So if you want to screen and have a very low sensitivity but high specificity, pick 100.4 degrees and you'll get about 1/4 of the COVID patients.
Wow.
1/2, that's 52%, exceeded a temperature of 37.5 or 99.4, compared with 10% of the COVID negative patients. That's not too bad either. So another threshold you could use is 99.4 or maybe 99, but the lower you get, the more you're going to get people who don't have illness. And if they looked at deviation from the individual patient's baseline, which is kind of the best way to do it, an increase in 0.9 degrees Celsius, that's 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit, occurred in 50% of the COVID patients and only 12% of the non-COVID patients. So that might be the best thing to do. The bottom line is that most older nursing home residents do have a temperature elevation when infected with the coronavirus, and that checking temperatures daily would be a way of picking up early around half the cases. This could be useful in a facility that was having an outbreak, as it could identify whom to test and isolate. Without an outbreak, you're more likely to find people who just have normal variation.
So beyond the bottom line, Dr. Sloan, are there any caveats to this study?
Well, the first is, of course, that checking temperatures will miss about half the people who will be COVID positive. And these are the folks who are likely having fewer symptoms. And another is that their data were based on 4 a.m. temperatures. And that's not feasible to do in a nursing home or a hospital. So in a way, this is not quite the ideal study. But once again, you know, in a nursing home, can you really do a temperature every day, even in the morning on people? I think it may be helpful if there's an outbreak going on, but for screening, maybe. It just depends. I don't know. What do you think, Wayne?
So, I mean, I guess I'm trying first off, very interesting information, and a lot of work went into this, and so I definitely laud the authors for bringing this to us. But at the end of the day, you know, thinking about what exists within a normal nursing facility, staffing, time, medication passes, all of that, and that it's kind of a coin toss with regard to determining, you know, whether a temperature is actually meaningful or anything. I have to wonder if at the end of the day, not the bottom line, but at the end of the day, if this study actually helps us to change or modify practices in the post-acute or long-term setting.
I think the best value of it is looking at what the normal is and what the curve is. It is a challenge because you want to do something.
Yeah.
And we can't test every week or every 2 weeks and just test everybody. So we have to have something for screening. So in that context, temperature is not a bad component of some kind of screening. You may want to screen for, and nobody's looked at this yet, if you screen for symptoms plus temperature, we get a little more sensitivity and specificity.
Well, all I have to say is that, you know, Dr. Brown's going to be talking about geriatric-centered care a little bit later, and a temperature at 4 o'clock in the morning in a long-term care setting is definitely not geriatric-centered care. Let's move on to our next clinical paper. It's about the role of bedside chest ultrasound in making a clinical diagnosis of COVID-19 pneumonia in nursing home residents. Fascinating, fascinating idea. And I have to be honest, I did not know that bedside chest ultrasonography could be used to diagnose respiratory illnesses. I'm just not in the know on that. I wonder how many of our readers do know of this tool's use. Dr. Sloan, lead us through this very interesting paper.
Well, it's from a group of physicians in Italy, which was, as you know, was the first Western nation to have a large national COVID problem. It's of relevance to nursing home physicians because it reminds us that ultrasound is a technique that has many uses. It's a feasibility study of 83 nursing home residents, average age 85, who presented with mild to moderate respiratory symptoms in northern Italy in April, where they were having COVID outbreaks in many nursing homes there. Reasons for the medical evaluation included fever in 63% and mild dyspnea in 40%. Each patient received an ultrasound evaluation at the bedside in the nursing home by one or more hospital-based geriatricians. Interestingly, their hospital has a mobile unit by which hospital-based geriatricians and rehab specialists consult in nursing homes. Kind of a nice thing. The person doing the ultrasound was an internist with 5 years' experience doing ultrasonography. They used a portable ultrasound device and rolling cart that's similar to the ones we have, several of them in our family medicine center. Of these 83 patients, remember, they had a reason to worry or be concerned about COVID. 33% had normal ultrasound lung exams. The other 67% had abnormal findings. Most common were what's called focal B lines or diffuse B lines. 50% had that finding, or subpleural consolidations, 39% had this finding. So this is a preliminary study done by a highly expert clinical ultrasonographer who is using a good machine. Now, I have to say, I've had some ultrasound training and have one of those little portable butterfly machines that's not good enough, but what they had was a pretty decent machine. And all the experienced ultrasonographers in emergency medicine claim that chest examination is one of the best and easiest areas of clinical ultrasound, at least in acute care. So I haven't reached that level of expertise, but I can't help wondering whether and to what extent having good ultrasound skills and a machine in the nursing home is part of the future of long-term care medicine, because it's really good for evaluating the chest.
Yeah, so I read this paper, I was fascinated, and at the end of the day, I was sitting thinking, you know, could you see clinicians coming to the skilled nursing facility to conduct chest ultrasonography? I mean, could this possibly be a consultant type scenario? You know, or could the SNFs have portable machines in-house? I mean, can you envision? I immediately can't envision this, but could you envision this as a possibility?
Oh, I so can't envision. I can envision this, definitely. Wow. Because I've done some ultrasound training. I've done some ultrasound, and we've got a machine, and I've used it, you know, in our clinic. And it's not that hard to do. And let's remember, COVID is shining a light on nursing homes, and nursing homes are going to have to up their game.
Yeah.
And also, we've got, I mean, you know, we're dinosaurs. We were trained a long time ago. But the new geriatricians are being trained. You know, our residents are getting ultrasound training. And what they need is the opportunity to use it enough. Now, a lot of nursing homes have bladder scanners.
Right.
An ultrasound machine, the costs are coming low enough that it's not going to cost that much more than a bladder scanner. You can, not only can you scan the bladder, you can look for DVTs, you know, you can check the chest. Abdomen is kind of hard to do, but there's a lot of stuff you can do. I think that there's a reasonable chance that this will be part of the future of long-term care medicine. And then we also have to remember that we're pretty dependent on the x-ray. And the x-rays in the nursing home are not very good. You know, they're portable, they don't get a lateral, the people don't take a deep breath. And if you've got an ultrasound machine and you're there, you can take a little bit of time and probably do a better job.
I think Dr. Brown and I are still pondering your "we're all dinosaurs" comment.
I am a dinosaur.
I am not, Wayne. And I think, I know that my residents are being trained in this. And so I completely actually agree with Dr. Sloan. I think that this is perhaps the best way that we'll be able to really scan our residents in time.
As an aside, if we are bringing in more and more technology, more appealing to the younger physicians, could we possibly entice more of the younger physicians to not so much consider geriatrics, but to consider, you know, purposefulness in the skilled nursing setting and wanting to be in that setting? So I guess
that's another topic I would love to talk about, because there's so many good reasons to do long-term care medicine.
Absolutely. Preaching to the choir on that one, regardless of dinosaur or Jurassic period. So Dr. Brown, the topic of ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blocker use during COVID-19 was one of the original questions and concerns that were expressed during the growth of this pandemic. And I was asked multiple times, but whether to stop these medications due to the, you know, the relation to ACE2 and what should people do in with regard to COVID. I did not have questions about statins, but our next paper out of Belgium, you know, demonstrates a number of issues with regard to these medications and COVID-19 outcomes. Can you lead us through this paper?
Absolutely. So I too, Wayne, ran into several questioning patients, as well as my own inquiry, really around the risk and benefit of continued use of ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and even statins just a bit since early on in the pandemic. I do see a number of younger, healthier, older adults, but I also have this subset of very vulnerable nursing home residents. And so this study was relevant to my clinical practice as it really investigated the association of angiotensin receptor blockers, ACE inhibitors, and statins with clinical manifestations of COVID-19 in just that population, those very vulnerable nursing home residents. In this retrospective multi-center cohort study, the clinical outcomes of COVID-19 were analyzed in the setting of the use of an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, and or a statin. They looked at 154 COVID-19 positive subjects, which the age was averaging right around 86 years old, that were identified residing in one of two Belgian nursing homes, both with similar COVID outbreaks. The outcomes were defined as one, serious COVID-19 defined as long stay hospital admission or death within 14 days of disease onset, and two, as an asymptomatic individual, so no disease symptoms in the whole study period while still being diagnosed by a PCR test. The study found a statistically significant association between statin intake and the absence of symptoms during COVID-19. Which remains statistically significant after adjusting for the covariates, age, sex, functional status, diabetes, and hypertension. There was no statistically significant association between the ACE inhibitors or ARBs and the asymptomatic status or serious clinical outcome for that matter. The data obtained in this study indicated that statin intake in older, frail adults, so our nursing home population, could be associated with a considerable beneficial effect on COVID-19 clinical symptoms. I thought that was fascinating. Mm-hmm. It did not, however, find a significant benefit or harm for older, frail adults taking an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. The combination of the two seemed beneficial, so the majority of the sample that was taking both remained asymptomatic throughout their course, but that number of patients on that combination therapy was relatively small. About 8 patients in the total sample size. I really appreciated this study and its specific focus on our oldest, most frail residents. Was it a practice changer? Perhaps. I think that more work is certainly needed with a larger population, but I would probably be less likely to stop the statin knowing this data. If a statin were indicated, I would be sure to start it. It doesn't seem that there would be harm in that regard. I think it is helpful to be able to share with patients and families that the nursing home residents in this study did not have poor outcomes when taking ACE inhibitors and ARBs, but it certainly wouldn't move me to start these agents or transition them for better blood pressure control quite yet.
Yeah, you know, and I guess my only comment or thought was, as I was reading this article, is a common one that we think about with regard to statins and the potential statin anti-inflammatory effect. And knowing from the information that's in so far regarding COVID-19 and its significant potential inflammatory effect, do you think that that's a potential correlation between statins and the symptom onset, et cetera?
That was the only link I could consider. And so I think so.
Yeah. Fascinating. Very interesting study. Let's move on to an article and a letter from the July 2020 issue of JAMDA, Dr. Brown, that specifically discuss family and visitation in general during COVID-19. And a lot of information around that, especially on the news and other outlets. For one author, the situation was a more personal one, it turns out. Obviously, with the phased reopenings, facilities are trying to accommodate more visitation, but the impact of isolation and loneliness has been palpable and a topic of discussion and frustration for many of my medical director colleagues. How do these writings help us to understand this unfortunate byproduct of the pandemic in the post-acute and long-term care setting?
As a physician who is currently in the CCRC that I work in, I fielded many questions on family or others, perhaps other important caregivers or people that are important in our residents' lives coming into the community. And I know that in the retirement community in which I work, I've had my temperature taken at the gate and had to give all of my information on symptoms, where I've been, what I've been up to since around March 5th. Wow. I'm a consistent and well-known staff member, and so they're doing their absolute best to keep these residents safe and to keep people out of campus. The residents here have teetered between gratitude for the safety insured and some potentially appropriate frustration about not seeing friends and loved ones, as I think is likely for all of us. Consistently, the themes of anxiety, loneliness, and depression have come up in conversation as we've put up tight bands and restrictions on interactions with family in an effort to really keep folks safe. I won't pretend I have the answers to all of this, but I thought the two articles highlighting reentrance were really interesting. Allowing visitors back into nursing homes during the COVID-19 crisis in this month's journal comes from the Netherlands, where a guideline has been released to cautiously open nursing homes for visitors during this pandemic. This cross-sectional study from 26 nursing homes reports on the first findings on how the guideline was applied in the local context, the compliance to local protocols, and the impact on well-being of residents, their family caregivers, and staff. A single contact person was identified in each facility, and they were asked to respond to questionnaires, telephone interviews, and analyses of documentation, as well as on a WhatsApp group. While some variation in local protocols was noted, the use of PPE, supervision of visits, the overall consensus was that the visits were really positive, as we would expect, I think. Each facility noted the added value of real and personal contact between residents and loved ones, and the value on general well-being of the residents in these nursing homes. The impressive part, no new COVID infections were noted in that 3-week time period.
Of course.
This article confirms for me, again, the value of in-person family visits and what they have on our nursing home residents, and leaves me optimistic. Perhaps there's real possibility for this in the somewhat near future. Phil, what do you think? What would you add? Wayne, what about you?
We just have to, and we're doing it now. We just have to get family in contact with nursing home residents. There's a lot that's been done about getting virtual visits and coming up with ways to communicate, but nothing is the same as in person. And, you know, for a lot of people in long-term care settings, their time frames are short in terms of, you know, how long they're going to see family and this kind of thing. And it's a big loss to lose 6 months or 12 months of seeing a grandchild, for example. So the trick is, how can we make that happen safely?
You know, one of the first things that we learned in geriatric fellowship, and I don't mean to just focus on geriatrics, because I think today we know it to be true throughout medical training, is the concept of touch. And mm-hmm. to not have the ability to touch somebody, it just creates that much more of not just a depersonalized environment, but an environment that lacks humanity. And I have seen innovations where, you know, people are not wearing, but kind of utilizing form-fitting kind of sheathing that allows them to be separate and protected, but still allows them to have some sort of contact with somebody on the other side of the sheathing as they can, you know, look through. So, you know, I agree with Dr. Sloan. You know, we need to innovate on this. We cannot have this section of our population punished because of this unfortunate virus and its sequelae. And so I know that there are people, at least in the Bronze Age, maybe not dinosaurs, but at least in the Bronze Age, thinking about this. And I know we'll have a remedy for this soon.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
The next article really talks about something that is kind of an innovation in terms of trying to walk the fine line between letting everybody in and doing something.
Absolutely. I certainly agree with you both. And I was excited to read this article initially because it is written by a former teacher of mine at the University of Cincinnati, but also excited because it does offer some real possibilities. So Dr. Jeff Schlodecker, who is a geriatrician out of the University of Cincinnati, shared a powerful letter to the editor about the importance of family members as critical caregivers and partners in the care we provide in nursing homes. Seems obvious enough, but in this time of COVID, it's been, I think, not as focused on as we should. So as many of us are aware, the CDC gave prevention guidelines on March 13th, stating that visitors should be excluded from long-term care facilities except in cases of compassionate care, such as end-of-life situations. Dr. Schlodecker makes the point that family is not synonymous with visitors. The daughter who feeds her bedbound mother lunch, or the husband who combs and braids his wife's hair every morning, despite her anoxic injury that prevents her spoken word, those aren't visitors in our buildings. The facility in which he works has appropriately limited the number of persons coming in and out, but in an effort to allow for the family members to play their critical role in care, they've designated essential family caregivers. These individuals, EFCs for short, are not there for social visits, but instead to help with the care of their loved one, whether that is a time-intensive hand feeding or providing one-to-one direction. This geriatric patient-centric model really exemplifies a thoughtful model of care to me and gives me hope that there are ways to engage family in meaningful and really appropriate interactions with our nursing home residents. Mm-hmm. What do you all think?
you know, when I read this letter, the first thing I thought was that as providers, we really can't be arrogant to think that care is limited to what we consider medically necessary care. You know, as an aside, I've been an advocate for years that the home is as much a part of the healthcare continuum than any other institution that we have, and everything that means for the home to be so. Similarly, the medical team for these folks, as you mentioned, Dr. Brown, really needs to include, we really need for it to include family and caregivers, you know, folks who are providing care, the type of care that is medically relevant, but care that we would never be able to give ourselves. And perhaps, you know, perhaps those in these settings can lead the way in finding, you know, what the true balance is between patient safety and patient wellness. So as I mentioned, the news is so full of COVID-19. The medical world is all about COVID-19. The world of post-acute and long-term care medicine is all about COVID-19. And the July 2020 JAMDA is all about COVID-19. A great way to conclude this segment of this podcast would perhaps lend to some perspective or speculation. You know, Dr. Sloan, what do you think will be the long-term result of all of this? You know, will we get a vaccine and go back to the way things were before? Or will the long-term care world fundamentally change? We've kind of talked about this, but, you know, what do you and what do you as the co-representative of JAMDA, you know, have to say?
Well, of course, now we're in the realm of speculation, you know, but it's also the $100 billion question, you know. I saw the movie Contagion, and in that movie, which is really worth watching, but once they had a vaccine, it was problem solved. You know? And that was a case with smallpox, but it took a couple hundred years, you know, to eliminate smallpox. And polio, it took 50 years. But with the flu, the vaccine is not really that much of a panacea. HIV, we don't have a vaccine. Dengue, the vaccine makes dengue worse for some people. And so the idea that COVID-19 will go away in a few months with a vaccine, I just don't know. It has certainly brought to the public's attention a number of problems with residential long-term care for older persons around the world. And so to regain that trust, we're going to have to do some action, but it's not really clear. I just think we're going to have a longer period of vagary about COVID than we would like.
You know, the lead article in the July 2020 JAMDA was by Chris Laxton, the Society Executive Director, along with David Nace, the Society current president, and Arif Nazir, the Society immediate past president. Their conclusion speculates about this. You know, these are truly three leaders in the field of post-acute and long-term care medicine, you know, not just for the society, but for all of us. They are amazing leaders. What did they have to tell us? What, you know, what were their insights around post-acute and long-term care with COVID-19 as a backdrop, you know, today and looking towards tomorrow?
Well, the article says a lot of things, and I can't really summarize it all, but among the other things I think are worth talking about, it explains how our nursing home infrastructure was really created 50 years ago. And there have been few substantive changes, you know, since the Nursing Home Reform Act, which is called OBRA 1987. You know, that was over 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's really time for some upgrading. Their last section talks about a broken system of care for our nation's older adults and raises some key issues that society needs to think about. And I'm going to quote from their last paragraph here. It is now up to us to turn this deadly crisis into something that makes these deaths, this misery, and this heroism contribute to a greater value beyond the immediate, namely the reinvention of how we provide care and support to our parents and grandparents, how we honor their sacred needs and wishes, how we celebrate and lift up those who have chosen the aging professions as a career, and how we build a just culture of true accountability.
I think that is just an amazing statement, but so much packed into that statement.
Now, there are macro issues, you know, about society's relationship with aging, and the more granular issues about how long-term care is structured. After spending a career waiting for society to awaken, you know, I spent 40 years waiting for society to awaken to the fact that aging is important. I finally concluded that we never will. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that old people aren't that interested in aging. They're interested in other stuff. And it's not until they get disabled they really care about kind of how the system works for old and disabled people. And then they don't have any political clout. So more likely in my mind will be further changes in the long-term care industry, you know, a reversal of the tide toward quality of life and instead toward greater infection control and medicalization. And that's a little bit scary because I'm not sure the resources are going to come to really do both.
Well, on an up note, our last paper to review in the July 2020 issue of JAMDA addressed a small but potentially important issue in our domain, the question of airflow in patient rooms. What did the authors demonstrate in this paper?
I really like this paper. You know, it's co-written by an environmental engineer and a nursing home administrator. It's very practical. It's called Practical Steps to Improve Airflow in Long-Term Care Resident Rooms to Reduce COVID-19 Infection Risk. And what it does is it explains that since the biggest route of COVID infection is airborne, facilities need to pay more attention to how air flows in their building. And not just on cleaning surfaces, which is more crucial for other diseases like C. difficile. And, you know, at first when COVID came out, we said, clean everything, clean everything, clean everything. We didn't talk about the air very much. Well, this article points out that hospitals design airborne isolation rooms to have negative pressure, and they propose that all nursing homes have at least some rooms that are designed in this manner. And it's not that hard to do. All you have to do is put an exhaust fan in the room that draws air out of the room, discharges it off to the roof, with the flow occurring at a certain rate, creating a slight vacuum. And retrofitting rooms to do this is basically just math. A little bit of duct work and installing a fan in each room. And then keeping the doors closed when people are exiting, except when people are exiting and entering. And if you want to see a patient, we could put a window in the door, and they can put a shade if they want to put it down. Of course, it goes without saying that these rooms should be single occupancy, and that is something that's definitely going to happen as a result of COVID-19. It's an acceleration of the trend in long-term care to get rid of multiple occupancy rooms and shared bathrooms. Both of these increase infection transmission way too much to be allowed in our future long-term care settings. Beyond building design, there are issues of staffing. Now, will, for example, there be more medical staff access, including specialists? You know, I was talking about how to redesign the system. You know, things like the portable ultrasound we discussed earlier. And what about nurse-patient ratios? And what about assisted living? At this point, we're all speculating. And I think we all need to weigh in and let our voices be heard. Mallory, do you think long-term care will change? And if so, how in this post-COVID world?
Yeah, Phil, I think to your points just before this, there has to be some changes. And in one sense, this is giving us the opportunity to think more about how do we care for people when they're really sick in the nursing home? How do we keep them there? And that's always, I think, been a goal, but even more so now when it's safer to be here or in the nursing home setting than to go to the hospital, thinking more creatively about that. I think it also is potentially a year or maybe more in which we have a space and place to think about creative ways to get family members involved, like we talked about, to utilize technology to the best of our abilities, and to think about just, again, how can we care for people in place? So, as you mentioned, using specialists to come in, doing that maybe through virtual care or e-consults, things along those lines. We've got some time while we await the end of this pandemic, if and when, that we can really think about these things. So I do think that long-term care will change.
Wayne?
Yeah, you know, as I was thinking about, I think about this all the time, but, and I know that I'm not alone in saying that as an educator of the post-acute and long-term care setting, you know, one of the things that I would say all the time to medical students, residents who would come through, or to colleagues who had aging patients who clearly were not thriving at home and needed something more, that they were not going to be, that they were not transitioning to an institution that we call long-term care. They were transitioning to another home, another place where they would call home. And I think that if we consider this concept of geriatric-centered care, and if we stop referring to long-term care as an institution, but as to another home option, I think that innovation and implementation of the things that we've been talking about might be more possible and more easily received. You know, at the end of the day, I get it. You know, we're talking about margins and being able to maintain a staff and maintain a building. I get all that. But I can't help to think that if we no longer thought of the nursing facility as a nursing facility, but we thought about it as a group of folks' home that provides specialty care, that things might be a little bit different. But that's just me.
We could talk about this for hours, couldn't we, Wayne?
We really could. But, let me just say, Dr. Sloan, kudos to you and obviously your editors like Dr. Brown and, of course, the co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Zimmerman. This issue of JAMDA is really phenomenal, you know, not just because it's talking about COVID, but because it's really bringing some insights that include technology and innovation and geriatric-centered care. And, you know, shows that people are really thinking about how to make this environment a better environment and a more inviting environment and in a home. And so, you know, under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief, Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, and with the support of editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Everyone out there, please take a look at the July 2020 issue. You will not be sorry. Dr. Sloan and Dr. Brown, thank you so much for spending your time again with JAMDA on the Go.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
References for this podcast can be found at www.jamda.com. And until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.